Good morning and welcome to Protecting Your Retirement with your financial professional, Don Wales, on KCMO Talk Radio 710 and 103.7 FM. I'm Grace Atkinson and so excited about today's show. As you know from the previous shows, it's not schools out for summertime. No, for all the seniors out there that have sadly failed at your retirement planning, it's time for Protecting Your Retirement Academy, also known as Annuity Summer School. Yes, that's right, everyone. Class is back in session today, so you can take your seats. You want to listen carefully and learn how protecting your retirement can help you safely navigate your retirement journey. You're going to learn why we refer occasionally to Protecting Your Retirement Academy as Skip School. And, of course, we want you to participate. Email us questions to info@protectingyourretirement.com or give us a call, 913-648-2700, and be a good student and participate in class today. And we're going to start today with a few questions that came from our students. Then we're off to some good news for boomers in the job market. But first, the professor, the star of the show today, Don Wales. Good morning, Don, and happy Father's Day.
Thank you, Grace, and happy Father's Day for your family as well and for all of our listeners. And we'll talk a little bit more about Father's Day later. Again, we have some questions called in. Actually called in, one called in, one emailed in from our listeners. And we're going to have Grace ask those, and then I'll give a response to them.
That's right. This first question is from Rose, and she would like to know, I understand how your firm helps us arrange some of our assets into fixed annuities so that we have our retirement budget well covered with income. When that is done and we still have other assets, Don, what should we do with those? And that is from Rose. Thank you, Rose.
Yeah, thank you for the question also. What we stress and what we try to practice is to use fixed annuities and fixed index annuities that we very strongly believe in because of their safety and their ability to be converted at some time at your choice into an income. And you can use that income to fill in any gaps in the budget between what you want to spend and what is coming in from other sources that are guaranteed for the rest of your life. So we use only enough of the assets that you have to do the annuities, set those up, and fill the gap. The rest of the money, now, if you have a well-thought-out budget, we've usually boosted that budget some because most people, when they make one out, don't really include everything. We usually boost it about 15-20%. And then also, we take that budget and inflate it by 3% a year all the way out to about age 100. So we have that budget, and we have it boosted over what you've told us you're going to spend. We also account for inflation at a rate of 3% a year. Then we use whatever assets are necessary to make up any gap that exists. Then if you have other assets, retirement assets left over, we suggest that they may be split between safe money choices, which would be annuities and bank deposits, maybe bonds, and the rest in the stock market, in the market or other market type instruments. That would include stocks, maybe equity traded funds, maybe some real estate investment trust, maybe some unit trust, various financial items that can be quickly, if necessary, converted to liquid or that already produce an income on a regular basis. Now, what we're doing right now at Protecting Your Retirement, we're having a series of meetings with some gentlemen, another local company, and we are trying to arrange a relationship with these local people, again, that have the same philosophy we do, that you need fixed income, and usually that's available through fixed annuities to cover any budget needs. But then after that, the things that they can provide, they have many choices. They manage money for a charge. They have almost everything they would recommend would have a stop loss, which means if it goes down beyond a certain percentage, it's going to be sold, and with no emotion involved. They provide individual attention to the clients, and their fees are lower than on many what you might be paying. You might be paying management fees now. You might have self-managed mutual funds. Those are generally, if you strip away all the cloud and the smoke, you'll find out that you're paying 3.5% to 4.5% if you're just using mutual funds. So we're trying to make an arrangement. We hope to have that ready soon, so that we will still concentrate our practice entirely on the use of fixed indexed, all safe money, no market risk annuities. But we will have someone that we are confident in that some of us will put our own money with, extra money, so to speak, and have a way for you to take advantage of other types of asset without sustaining a big market risk.
Well, that sounds very exciting, Don, and we look forward to hearing more details about that in the weeks to come.
Mm-hmm. You will. Definitely will.
Well, there was good news last week when the job numbers came out. AP's David Melendi reports.
Employers added another 217,000 jobs last month, about as expected, and the Labor Department says the unemployment rate held steady at 6.3%, which economists had expected to tick higher. Mesirow Financial Chief Economist Diane Swank says that would not have been a bad thing.
More people should be throwing their hat in the ring and looking for a job, so that's why we would want it to go up.
That would have been a sign of more labor force participation because of better job prospects. Still, job gains have now averaged 234,000 in the past 3 months, and the job market has reached a significant milestone, regaining all of the jobs lost in the Great Recession. David Melendi, Washington.
If you look inside the numbers, it seems the news is even better for boomers. They seem to be employed at higher rates than millennials. Don, do you think this is good news or is this bad news?
No, I think it's good news. And, of course, I'm in a boomer generation. So, anyway, we like to see our peers and our relatives that are, you know, in similar age having a good job picture. But anyhow, there's an article that we have, and it says why boomers are winning on the job front and millennials are not. And there's a new study by CareerBuilder.com, and according to that, the number of jobs held by baby boomers aged 55 to 64 grew 9% from 2007 to 2013.
Wow.
That was a gain of 1.9 million jobs. Those jobs were newly acquired by boomers over age 55, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And everyone says, oh, no one hires anyone over 50, okay? Well, maybe in some fields they don't, but someone is. However, the millennial workforce, which is age 22 to 34, has not recovered nearly so fast, with an increase of only 110,000 jobs, and that was essentially unchanged from the 2007 level. On the other hand, boomers over the age of 55 have chosen to stay in the workforce longer than they might have otherwise to make up for lost earnings and savings depletion during a prolonged recession. But the data shows that the boomers were the only age group to increase their labor force participation since 2007. Millennials saw a 2.1% drop in their labor force, which means more of them gave up than, you know, the older generation. The occupational groups are a little different. There's been a spike among millennials working in food preparation and serving. Those are low-level jobs requiring few skills. Not that they don't have the skills. Most of them have college educations.
Mm-hmm.
But they cannot find jobs to use the skills that they're educated for. On the other hand, more boomers are working in healthcare, business, and the legal professions, which typically require more skill. So within the stats of how many jobs were picked up in a certain month or over a series of months, the people age 55 to 64 are actually doing better than those young whippersnappers with their MBAs and whatnot. And not having anything against them, we like to hire them. They're real helpful.
I'm sure.
But anyway, you know, tech world. But it's something I would not have expected. And very often I meet people in their 50s or early 60s who maybe they've been downsized or, you know, somehow have lost a job, or maybe their skills didn't keep up with particular occupational needs, and they'll say, well, I've got to start a business or I've got to do something else because no one is going to hire anyone over 50. This report flies right in the face of that.
Well, a recent CBS MarketWatch article suggests that baby boomers could learn a thing or two from retirees from the 1950s. The article points out the retirees back then had fewer financial resources but didn't feel shortchanged. Don, are there some good lessons to be learned from how our grandparents approached their retirement decades ago?
Absolutely. And I think that if I look to my own grandparents who retired, you know, in the 50s, on my dad's side, my grandfather worked as a last maker. That was basically a carpenter in a shoe factory. They made a wooden form that then they made the shoes over. It's called a last. Oh. But anyway, worked for the same company 52 years and then retired. And he just retired. I don't recall him doing anything, you know, during that time of any attempt to make money or anything. My other grandfather was police chief in our community when I was young, and that kept me straight. So he retired. It kept me straight after that, too, but because everyone knew him. But anyway, the other grandfather was police chief, and he had an involuntary retirement. He was a chief of police, there were two political parties in the town, a union party and a village party. He was probably identified with one. The other one got a majority on the village board, and Gus was out. And so, but what he did then was immediately became chief of security at a racetrack, at a horse racetrack.
Oh.
And he did that for several years and then really did retire. And so anyhow, people who retired in the 50s were working adults during the Great Depression, which was in, what, the 30s. So they weren't strangers to hard times. Most everybody worked as long as they were able to. And in their later years, they often hired help because a lot of them had a farm or a business, which was usually also their primary asset. So farmers often aspired to pass a farm along to their children, whereas a business owner either passed it along to the next generation or sold it to finance the owner's retirement. Some people worked in local factories, retired in the 50s, and only a few had pensions. But factory workers were the only people who counted the days until they could retire, and that's because they would probably get a pension.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the farmers and the shopkeepers took pride in and were fulfilled by their work. They valued their social interactions and the role they played in their community. So therefore, their work was, quote-unquote, enjoyable. The resources retirees had to get by on. In 1950, the average Social Security benefit was $29 per month.
Oh, my goodness.
In 2012, the average benefit was $1,262 a month. And in 2012 dollars, that $29 average benefit back in 1950 translated to about $280, which is pretty low.
Yeah.
About $1,000 low, which means the average Social Security benefit in 2012 is worth about 4.5 times the average benefit 1950. And so, you know, we have, you know, facts like that. Since money was scarce in the 50s for retirees, they were quite frugal, spending just on basics like food, clothing, and shelter. Many people grew their own fruit and vegetables, and some of them canned produce for the winter. Many retirees didn't own a car, or they owned only one. Two-car families hardly existed. There were very few TVs. By the way, we lived in an apartment when I was a young child up to about 7 or 8 years old. And we did have a TV almost as soon as they came out, a little black and white. It's something my dad just had to get for us. But no computers, no cell phones, no entertainment centers. Long-distance telephone calls were expensive.
Yeah.
So people usually communicated with, guess what, writing letters.
Yes.
Regular mail. And, you know, we had retirees that pursued hobbies, active in the church and community. That's the same now, I think. And vacations usually meant driving to neighboring counties or states to visit relatives. A few people went to Europe on vacation, and Florida and Arizona as retirement destinations were not an option for most people. So quite a few differences. You know, today's retirement crisis, so to speak, has been well documented. You don't want to diminish it. But we have a lot of advertising that says we'll be more satisfied if we have this and that and go here and go there. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't the case because there was no internet, and, you know, the advertising was limited to radio and the beginning part of television. So, you know, the author that wrote this article is from Money Watch. But anyhow, the author says, a piece of advice, and I agree with it, instead of comparing ourselves to the Joneses, let's focus on what we really need, what we can realistically afford, and what truly makes us happy. After all, the Joneses are most likely in the same boat, so what good is it trying to keep up with them and being a boating person? Yeah.
Yeah, that's good sound advice.
I admire those big cabin cruises that go by, but I don't need one.
Well, there
and,
you go.
Happy with my little sport boat. But anyway, yeah, there's some lessons to learn. Frugality, only purchasing what you need. And, you know, you don't have to do everything that everyone else does. And, you know, when we talk about our next article or next topic, we're going to touch on marriage counseling. And now that's not our occupation. Sometimes we feel that we have to do that, though.
Sometimes moms and dads have different ideas about how to approach retirement. Some financial planners have to almost act as marriage counselors. Dawn, how do you help couples reach some common ground in retirement planning? That can be touchy.
Actually, what I do is, if there at our conference table, generally, even though we invite people to sit wherever they wish, it's inevitable that one of the couple will sit on one side and spouse on the other side, and I sit at the head of the table. Now, I don't deserve the head of the table. I don't assume it. I don't set out my material there, you know, to indicate that this is Don's seat, but, you know, that's where I end up, usually with a wife on one side and a husband on the other. So that kind of almost puts me in the middle. But when they start arguing, I just kind of listen, and I'm quiet. But I move my chair back several feet so that, you know, if they come to blows across the table, I'm not in the target range. Okay. But anyhow, that doesn't happen often. But we do end up with differences of opinion. And I guess what we have to do is encourage people to determine whether or not they share priorities. And, you know, it could be very well if there's only one major breadwinner in the family, that person might have a really big priority on retiring, you know, giving it up and not working anymore. And the other one who is, you know, used to, you know, maybe being at home and is more knowledgeable about what things really cost on a day-to-day, week-by-week basis, might not put that as as high a priority, or what in the world am I going to do with him if he's around all the time? You know, and also there needs to be agreement on what is acceptable risk. We don't really have a whole lot of problems with that when we're talking to couples. We do see, and I think we can document this pretty well, men are willing to take more risk than women, generally speaking, and more men approach retirement planning and taking care of the money, getting ready for retirement. More of them are willing to do it yourself, take on a do-it-yourself role. Well, I can do that. You know, I can get on the internet, or I can talk to Joe, who knows everything about the market, and do it myself and do just as well. And I think that's a dangerous attitude. And usually the people that have that attitude very strongly have a spouse that does not share that attitude. So what is acceptable risk, and how do we either manage our money or have someone help us ordain the money in a way that it's going to fulfill our goals? And, of course, one of the items that we're reading about is called We Are Family. And AgeLab did some research, and it found that spouses may have different perceptions of who is a priority in retirement planning. For example, men may be more likely to identify their wife and themselves as a primary focus of their retirement planning and their financial priorities. Mm-hmm. That's men. It's you and me, baby, and our priorities, okay? Our finance. In contrast, women are more apt to include their adult children, their grandchildren, and even their siblings as being of equal and critical importance to their retirement planning goals. So you might be a guy that, you know, with a wife and, you know, it's, you know, you and me, and we're going to get through this. We're going to spend our grandkids or our kids' inheritance and move right on. Whereas women might be thinking, well, our adult children, we can always help them some more. Mm-hmm. Our grandchildren,
yeah,
and siblings, you know, that's getting it out there. And that's from a male point of view, of course. But anyway, you know, there can be some differences of opinion. What we run into in actual practice of protecting your retirement sometimes is that people will have money with us, and it's in fixed annuities or fixed index annuities. There is some liquidity available. In other words, you can take some money back out, you know, every year if you wish, up to certain levels without any bad consequences, called surrender charges. And we'll have people that want to take out and spend other than on what was in that budget that we prepared way at the beginning.
Yeah.
And one or the other of the couple will have an idea about taking out sometimes pretty substantial chunks of money to do things that really are not on the normal operating expenses or emergency expense, maybe doing big home improvement projects once you're already retired and actually in the same home that you've been living in, you know, during the working years. So we do see things like that, or maybe the fishing just would be a lot better. They'd bite better, you know, if I had a new bass boat. So we see things where maybe the wife will call up and say, okay, how much can we take out without any surrender charge this year? And because we're going to do X. And then a few days later, husband will call, how much is it that we can take out this year and no surrender charge? And what's our tax going to be on it? And, you know, can we really afford that? And you get the idea. She has a plan to spend, and he doesn't.
You're kind of stuck
the other
in the
way.
Middle there.
Yeah, and so we just keep it on the facts. And, you know, I'll say something like, well, if it's an expenditure that looks like it's out of sync with income, out of sync with assets, or needs debt to handle part of it, then I'll usually say something like, you know, we really need this, and the money that you put in this now is money that cannot create more income later. So whatever you do now with that retirement bucket of income, unless it's invested in some positive way with a guarantee that you can turn into an income, is money that is spent, not money saved, and not money available later to enhance your income if that is a necessity later on, or even to pay for things that inflate beyond expectations later on, like health care, long-term care.
Well, you want your nest egg to grow. You don't want to siphon off of it. It defeats the purpose of planning for your retirement.
And really, when we have these discussions, it is never, ever, from our point of view, from our self-interest, we don't charge fees. We get paid when we convince someone to do an annuity as a safe financial choice. We get paid a commission at that time, at the beginning, and it's not like a trail like on life insurance where every time you make a premium payment, we get a little bit of it. On the annuities, we get it, and that's it. And when money flows out, like when you take money out of the annuity contract, when you convert it to income, when you pass away and there's a death benefit, that has no financial impact on us whatsoever. It has an emotional impact. But when we see people turning on the tap too far on their retirement assets, especially ones that we have helped them establish with the idea of safety, guaranteed growth, guaranteed income, then, you know, it's just part of our job, really, to try to slow it down. But we're not evaluated by any of our companies on how much comes in versus how much goes out. I have absolutely never seen a report of that nature, and I'm appointed with over 40 companies. The purpose of an annuity is to protect, grow, and distribute your money back to you. The purpose is not to enrich the insurance company beyond the small percentage that they make on all of that money that is there during the time it's present.
Don is getting ready to share some scary stories related to people buying their own life insurance. If you have questions, the number 913-648-2700. Don, tell us what happened.
Twice already this year, One time we learned of a relative of a client having this situation, and then recently one of our clients. People, and especially senior citizens or even younger people, get solicited to buy life insurance over the internet, in direct mail, in newspaper ads, where it says only a few health questions or no physical required, no medical records required, 5-7 simple questions, and you can have life insurance. And what you do is either fill out a form or you call an 800 number or you go online and you purchase life insurance. And the premiums are pretty inexpensive, and they don't have many health questions. They might have a few of the main ones. Are you currently suffering from cancer? Or have you had a recent heart attack? But very, very light on what we call the underwriting. And you just check yes and no on 5 questions or 7 questions, send in your money or set up an automatic debit from your bank account, and presto, the life insurance policy arrives at your home. You feel like you've really done good for your family. They're going to have enough to take care of the funeral or burial expenses, maybe a little left over. And, you know, you then pass on with a peace of mind that you've done this. Now, here's what happens. After your demise, when someone makes the claim for the death benefit, that is when the insurance company does their underwriting. In traditional purchasing of life insurance, the underwriting is done up front before the policy is issued. Mm-hmm. We ask a lot more health questions. We ask some financial questions, and you have a physical, usually blood work and urinalysis work, physical measurements so that you're not fibbing too big about the weight and height. And then the policy, if it's suitable, is issued. With these do-it-yourself, the direct mail or other advertising, the insurance company, as long as you pay the premium, they issue the policy. But after your demise, then they do the underwriting. And the underwriting is, number one, they get a copy of the death certificate. If there's a carcinoma or a heart attack, a coronary, chances are they're going to immediately deny the claim, not pay the death benefit.
What a nightmare.
And then, if it's not clear on the death certificate, what they're going to do is write back and sorry about your loss. We're going to take a little more time before we pay out the claim. We want medical records from every physician, hospital, clinic who has seen your departed loved one over the last X number of years. They have the right to do this. Mm-hmm. If they find out that any of those questions were not answered accurately by the person who applied for the insurance, they will deny the claim and they will not be punished for it. Basically, what it comes down to in real nitty-gritty is you lied on your application. Or you forgot something on your application. And we've seen it twice now. And in both cases, it left the family unable to easily pay for the final expenses. But guess what? The funeral, the burial, the flowers, that was already done. And, you know, they have a bill at the florist. They've got a bill over at the funeral home. In one case, they actually assigned the life insurance to the funeral director, who was the first to find out that the company was not going to pay the claim. So when it's quick and easy and it's cheap, not the way to buy life insurance, if you deal with an agent like ourselves, we will ask the right questions. If you have a health issue, we will usually know how to explain it, and we'll know by calling underwriters at the insurance companies which company might accept this particular health risk, or maybe they'll charge a little more premium or a lot more premium, but we know how to either get it through if it can be done, or to say, hey, we don't think you're insurable. But we've got over 40 companies that we deal with, and usually, maybe sometimes with an upcharge, a higher premium, you can get people in reasonable health, or with formerly scary health history, we can get them an amount of life insurance.
Don, one more quick question in this segment as we quickly, we're running out of time, but this is critical. If you could share, what should someone need to know if, when planning for their retirement, they need to think about possibly taking care of one or more of their elderly parents?
Well, you have the possibility of taking care of an elderly parent. What I'll focus on, because we don't have a lot of time, is how to help you manage your parents' money. And that will be to understand your role. And it depends on whether you have a power of attorney or a trustee of their trust, or you're just, doing it out of, your love for the family that you're taking care of. to parents' money to avoid anyone scamming them or, taking their money. So you have to understand your role. A written role is better, like a power of attorney or a trustee or a court-appointed guardian. You need to have your parents document everything for you. If they're writing their own checks, paying their own bills, still have a credit card, you need to be aware of absolutely every transaction. And that will help you help them stay on budget. Also, you'll have clues as to what might be going on that isn't right within either their expenditures, or maybe there's another family member, maybe a sibling that's tapping the parents, from time to time. And also, you need to document everything that you do and write notes about why did you make this financial decision? Why did you get rid of the financial advisor they've had all their life and move to a new one? Mm. Or why did you move them to a different residence? You have to prepare in case the money runs out. Are you going to make up the difference? Are you helping them get on Medicaid? Are you going to siblings or other relatives for help? Or are you turning to the public sorts of help for the elderly? You have to determine details, for when the parents pass away or when they may become mentally challenged in older life. Will they need help completing normal tasks? And I'm going to add a final item on that. Also know about their life insurance and be very cautious if they are buying life insurance, especially because they had a card that they pulled out of a magazine, maybe a senior citizens magazine. No medical questions. Everyone issued up to age 85, low monthly premiums. When you see that and no health questions or very few, you should know that the insurance company, if they're going to pay out more than the premium they received, they're going to do a little investigating before they write the check.